Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne Maria DeMars. And we have with us today our very special guest, Dr. Carol Davis.
Hello, everyone. This is Carol.
So Carol, for those of you who are not fortunate enough to know her, is amazing. She became a teacher through a program at Turtle Mountain Community College, which we're going to talk about shortly. She has a doctorate. She was involved in the founding of the tribal college on her reservation. She's been the principal investigator of a number of National Science Foundation grants. She's well known as, and I know she'd be too modest to say this, so I'm going to say it for her, a leader and mover and shaker in tribal college education and education in general on reservations throughout the country. And she has been married for 53 years, so that's something we hopefully could get her insight on. So, Maria, did you want to dive in with some questions?
Well, one thing that Anne-Marie has talked a lot about and that she really attributes a lot to education on Turtle Mountain and the quality of education there is there was a program that you were involved in as far as teacher education and that really, in some ways, might set a model for Native education. And can you talk a little bit about that program?
The Mayville program, that was back in the 80s. After Turtle Mountain Community College was established, there was a lot of interest in education on our reservation. And one of the things that Turtle Mountain Community College, which was in existence then, one of the things they did was go to Mayville State University and asked if they would be interested in bringing a program to Turtle Mountain Reservation where they could train teachers. And they did this. They had about three or four cohorts of about 20 teachers in each one, and they were offering elementary education degrees. And I think I was in the third cohort, second or third, I think it might have been third cohort of students. And that's where I got my elementary ed degree.
It's always seemed to me, and you're the expert, so you can tell me I'm wrong if you want, but it's always seemed to me that that had a profound difference, because now you have 60 people on the reservation, all of whom have college degrees. So first of all, the kids now see people because, you know, and I don't think this is a rude thing to say, I think it's true, a lot of people on the reservations are related to each other. So it's very likely that a child has somebody in their family with a college degree now. And then on top of that, it's very likely that they have a teacher who's from their tribe, because most of those teachers stayed on that reservation, right?
Right. These were local people who most of them had by this time gone through 2 years of training at the local college. They were picking up a lot of teacher aides, and those teacher aides were then going into teacher training programs. I was actually a teacher aide, so we went to evening classes. Many of us worked all day, went into evening classes. So when you walk around and see the teachers that were back from the Mayville program, that's pretty much what many of us were doing.
And having teachers that look like the students in the communities they're working with, that's something that there's a lot of talk about, whether it's the Latino community or the Black community or the Native community. What impact does that have? How do you think that that plays out for the students to have teachers that are from their community and look like them and kind of have a shared background in a lot of ways? What impact does that have and what difference does that make?
I think it's in our community, and I can't speak for any other, but I think it made a lot of difference in our community because everybody sort of knows everybody. And so we know the families. We know kind of how to motivate the students. I think from the teacher standpoint, it made it a lot easier. Teacher, from the student standpoint, I would say some of them were being taught by cousins, uncles, aunts, once they've been through the program, or a neighbor. So it have, an impact both ways.
Yeah, it seems like it was such a successful program. And I even noticed that coming to North Dakota, not knowing anything about it, the Turtle Mountain seemed to have a higher proportion of students going to college. I don't know if that's still the case, but I know when I was there, it seemed like for a long time, Turtle Mountain had a higher graduation rate. And I always attributed that to the fact that so many of the teachers came from that community. And I wonder, with that success, why wasn't that replicated on other reservations more?
I really don't know, but I think the fact that, you know, we're on a 6x12 reservation, the county is sort of ours. We have about, maybe right now, we probably have around 14, 15,000 of our tribal members living right here in this one county. And so I think that maybe the close proximity of us to each other versus when you're in the large reservations, people live so far apart that, you know, they don't see the impact. Maybe that has something to do with it. And then we don't have to drive as far to get to the college and to get back. And so that could have an impact.
Oh, that really makes sense. And for people listening who don't know, what she means, Turtle Mountain is 6 miles by 12 miles. For those of you who play Seven Generation Games, you know right away that that's 72 square miles, which is not a lot.
Yeah, we've got Fish Lake right here in the middle of our
Well, yeah, I was just at Fort Berthold visiting with Bruce Gillette, and yeah, driving around there compared to Turtle Mountain, you're right, it's night and day, and I just never really thought about that. And before they built those new bridges, it was even more of a hassle. So, yeah, that's a really good point. See, that's why you're the forefront of education, because you think about those things, and we don't.
And then I think, too, that, you know, we had such a dynamic president back in the day, Cardi Monette. I think, you know, a lot of the success of the college and the people comes from, you know, the work that he and a few others did in those very early years to really put a solid foundation behind the college. I remember one time where we were sitting in a meeting, and I had never heard this, and I had worked at the college probably 6 or 7 years already, and we were sitting at a table with the tribal chairman trying to work through an issue for the tribe, and it was brought up that Cardi, who was probably in the president's position maybe a year or two at that time in the very early years before funding became solid, he had a family of maybe 3 or 4 small children, and he worked for 3 months without a salary, even though he had a master's degree and could have been working elsewhere. He believed so strongly in that college that he worked for 3 months without a salary to make sure that it didn't fail. So I think when you've got that kind of commitment at the top, and he was there for almost 40 years, when you've got that kind of commitment at the top, it's bound to trickle down into the community and into the staff members, and people knew the value of what he was doing. And so I think, you know, that had a lot to do with the success of the college, which then was made it possible for the success of the people, because without a college, you wouldn't have had so much success here. Another comment that I heard, this was recently, a lady from the Bush Foundation was here at Turtle Mountain, and she asked a group of us why there were so many doctors at Turtle Mountain, tribal members. And she said, in proportion to other tribes, your tribe definitely has something going on with doctors. And we do. You know, every year we have a number of people who earn their doctorates, and then we read about others who are working on their doctorates. So it's, you know, it's one of those things that our tribal members do value. But again, there's a big segment of our population that have not participated. You know, we make it sound because we have maybe 1,000 people in our community now that have degrees, and we have, you know, a lot of opportunity through education, but we've got a segment of our population that's unemployed, 60% unemployment. And sometimes I ask the question, you know, are we now educating the second and third generation of the same families while we leave out others? And those are some things that we as a tribe have to figure out. And then do we go first generation? Do we give some kind of funding priority to first generation from families who still haven't had the opportunity to participate? So we have those issues, and I think we'll eventually resolve some of them and address some of them. We're not really addressing them right now, but I think we will.
60% unemployment, that's crazy.
Yeah, and you know, the people without a two-year degree can't even get a job here. You got to almost have a two-year degree to do any kind of competing, because we have so few jobs on the reservation.
Let's go back to that, because you mentioned Cardi, who I think is a good example of what Eric Lanchi told me years ago. And this was an insight to me, because I didn't understand sometimes why people thought or acted so differently than I thought I would in their position. And he told me that there are two kinds of people that become college president. There are the people who see the college as a force for good in the community. They see that a tribal college can be center around which economic development happens. It can be a way for people to get an education without leaving their families. It can be a way for people to learn both their culture and get an education. He said there's those kind of people. And then there are the people that they'd like to be introduced as college president. They like the committees they're asked to be on. They like, you know, how people stand up when they enter the room. And I think Cardi was that first type.
I think so, too. Yeah, I worked with him, and I believe that's fair to say that he was that type.
And then there was that woman that they had as the interim and acting president and who was the academic vice president for many years. She was pretty amazing, too, right?
She worked hard.
See, that's the other thing, too. If I was a college president, I might be that second type. I might make everybody, Maria, Jonah, everybody here would be addressing me as President and Maria. But, you know, I think that says something about you, too, that you have had all these accomplishments and you rarely speak about them. But I think that's good. You know, let other people talk about them. Speaking of which, so can you talk a little bit about being involved in founding tribal colleges in the Great Plains? Because I know you were.
That was back in the 70s. And I'll start it out this way by saying today I recommend to leaders that they not overlook the youth and what they're wanting to do and what they're seeing as an opportunity. Because tribal colleges across this country were founded by a bunch of 25-year-olds. And when we got together and started to dream about these colleges, we were actually a threat on our reservations to the powers that be. And then sociology has terms for that, but they want to keep the status quo because it's good for them. Well, those days are long gone here, of course. But in those early days when nobody had an education, it was like they wanted to keep their power bases. But we came in as we were a paradigm shift on our reservations from that old status quo of politicians running everything to now we were looking at educated people running things. And when we looked at tribal colleges, I think Wayne Stein and his research found that the founding missions of the tribal colleges showed that what we really wanted for our people was to embrace our own history and culture. We wanted to learn and teach about our tribal governments. We wanted to learn about our ceremonies and become who we really were. Why should we learn about a city government and have to answer questions in our textbook and not know anything about our tribal government? And those kind of issues were there. Another thing was happening was we had such a high dropout rate from the universities in the state, and we were spending all of our money, scholarship money, I mean, sending students to the universities for 1 month, paying tuition, paying their room and board for a semester, and they were back here. And that money was already gone. And we said if we could spend that money at our own tribal colleges, we could employ people, they would get a more relevant education. The students coming back from the universities wouldn't have to be re-educated into their communities. They would actually have this information when they came back. So we had a vision for tribal colleges, and that's what we pursued.
We'll be right back.
Did you know that kids on average lose 2.5 months of math skills over the summer? That means that when they go back to school this fall, it's almost like everything they learned in math since mid-March never happened. Seventh Generation Games can help. Combining adventure gaming and math, our games are the perfect way to keep kids' math skills up to date. It's not flashcards or worksheets, but 3D video games and engaging apps that kids actually want to play, even when they're on summer break. Check us out at 7GenerationGames.com.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by 7 Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm still Anne-Maria DeBars. And we still have with us the amazing Carol Davis, Tribal College founder, president, amazing researcher, and what Maria wants to talk about next.
Anti-fracking advocate. And I wanted to talk about this because this is a thing. We live in LA and a lot of people will say things like, I'm against fracking, and, you know, they post tweets and things like that. But you've actually been very active kind of on the front lines of the move to have fracking on you guys' land and just larger issue of all of the negatives and things that come along with fracking. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that because, like I said, a lot of people I know do what, you know, we talk about is hashtag activism, you know, no fracking. But really getting more in depth to that whole issue and everything that goes into fighting against it?
Well, for us, it started back in 2011. And at that time, one of my friends, Larry Dufany, contacted me and he asked me if I had seen a certain article that was written by one of our tribal members in the Minot newspaper. Minot, of course, being the kind of the closest city to us. And I said, yeah, I had seen it. And I said it was about Fort Berthold's oil. And I said, we're those lucky people. Once again, they get the benefits of oil and we get nothing. And he said, that's not what I'm talking about. He said, I'm talking about fracking. And he said, what did you think of what he said about fracking? And I had no idea what it was, because he had written something that was pretty much in favor, and my frame of mind at the time was just oil and money. And he said, I need to tell you about fracking. And so he gave me a short overview of what fracking was. A week later, we were all sitting together at a book party talking about a book we had read, and the conversation turned to fracking again. And this time there was a gentleman there who had worked for the Indigenous Environmental Network, Native American Network, and he had been involved in fracking and told us what it was about, and I just panicked. And so when I got home from this book party, it was pretty late, and I had thought about it, and I thought, just really bad. And so the next morning, after a sleepless night, I called a lady that I had been in a ceremony with a couple years earlier, maybe 8-10 years before that, where the spiritual leader reminded us that women were responsible for the water in our tribe, in Ojibwe society, and the men are responsible for fire, for the fire, and how they lived in balance, and it was really a nice teaching that went with it. And she said, Carol, bring some tobacco and come over here. And I found out that they had been in ceremony and were getting messages that there was something wrong with the water. And so we decided that the water spirits were speaking to the tribes, and that we needed to be alerted to the fact that this was not a safe process. And so we pulled together about what we thought would be around, we invited about 40 women and told them to go ahead and bring their spouses. And we, over time, probably ended up with about 75 people total that were coming into our meetings. We started having weekly meetings and invited the tribal chairman to the meeting and the whole council, but the chairman came, Mal Finkler, and he invited us into the tribal meeting. And when we explained our findings about fracking and how they use 2 million, as much as 2 and 4 million gallons of fresh water, 2% of that being chemicals, we showed the tribe that, you know, if you're using that much water and 2% is chemicals, you could line up these big milk trucks we meet on the road, these big silver milk trucks, put about 15 or 16 of them in a row and fill them up with chemicals. That's how much goes in one well. So the tribe got very concerned at that point, because we have one point where we all get our water, not all, but the majority, in our rural water system connected to the Shell Valley Aquifer. And we said, if somebody were to drill a well on the Shell Valley Aquifer and destroy that water, we would have no water for the people, because that's where our main source is from. And our lake, Fish Lake, our beautiful Fish Lake, has blue-green algae, which is contaminant, also a threat to our water, but we cannot use that as a secondary source anymore. So we got active. The tribe invited us into a meeting, and that was interesting too, because I sometimes wonder what was happening here. We went into the tribal council to educate and share information with them on the Friday before the open public meeting, which was scheduled on Tuesday. On Monday morning, the Turtle Mountain Times and the Turtle Mountain Star published a call for bids to the oil companies to bid on land. There were 42 parcels of land that were put up for oil lease bids on the Turtle Mountain Reservation. So we found out about this in the paper. So when we went before the Tribal Council on the open public meeting, we asked to amend the resolution that we had brought to them that Friday, and they let us amend it, and we added that we demanded that the Bureau of Indian Affairs withdraw those oil lease bids. And it took a little while once the resolution, and the resolution passed unanimously by the Tribal Council. And then it took a little while to get the superintendent to act on it. He has to act on all our major resolutions. And I kept bugging him, and it just wasn't happening. And finally he told me, he said, the solicitor is writing the letter. If I write it, I might say the wrong thing, and the oil lease will go forward. So the solicitor of the Department of the Interior actually drafted the letter that called back the bids, and the bids were canceled. I got a call from some lady at the tribal office, and believe me, I mean, if I could remember, I'd probably splash her name all over. I cannot remember, but I get this phone call, and she says, just wanted you to know that the superintendent sent out about 100 letters today to oil companies, and I believe he has withdrawn those bids. Click. So they called back the leases, and we banned fracking. Then our committee went before the tribe and rewrote our Water Act for the tribe. So that was put out for a 30-day comment period. And we have a new Water Act that actually bans fracking. And it acknowledges where our people, our original treaty signers back in Macumber Agreement in the 1890s, where they had actually left the water in common to all the people. So they were consciously aware that water was very important to our tribe. And so we used that language in the Water Act as well. So that was what we did about banning fracking, and it had everything to do with the harsh chemicals that were being used in the process, benzene, and there were about 9 carcinogens. And of course, government has, with the Halliburton loophole, they withdrew fracking from the Clean Drinking Water Act, and that's why the companies can get away with using those harsh chemicals in the fracking process, is because they hide behind the proprietary law. But we feel that we're protecting our water, and we have published our resolution and our Clean Drinking Water Act. Well, it's not the Clean Drinking Water Act, it's the Water Act for the tribe. And they're both published on the Tribal Nations Research Group website, and we invite all tribes to do that. As we have done, copy what we've got. We put our resolution out there, and we said, copy it. Everybody should be working to protect the water.
Well, and as you were talking, I was thinking some people who are listening might not be familiar that much with fracking. And as somebody who's advocated a lot for it, you can probably explain it, you know, in layman's terms a little bit better than me. How do you explain fracking to people? You were talking about, too, you had to educate a number of the members of the tribe even. How do you break it down to people?
Basically, we showed a PowerPoint presentation to the tribe, and we listed the chemicals that have been identified as carcinogens, cancer-causing chemicals. And we show that this is part of the process of fracking. And then we show the picture of the big semi-trucks with these huge 5,000-gallon silver milk trucks, is what we call them in our presentation. And we say, put 16 of these in a row and fill them with chemicals. And that's how much chemicals go into one well. And it would only take, our Shell Valley Aquifer is about maybe 20 by 30 miles. It would only take a quart of benzene or less in that aquifer to destroy the whole aquifer for 100 years. And benzene isn't the only carcinogen. There's about 9 carcinogens that are being used. And then we show, we also explain how the well process, the fracking process is how they dig deep wells into the ground, and then they explode. They use electricity and chemicals to explode these lines, and then the oil seeps into those pipes, and they pull it back out with pressure. And these chemicals that are in these wells come up. Some of them seep up the sides, and they tell you that they're encasing everything, but they blow up the cases. So the chemicals don't sit in one place. They start moving underground, and they're all over. That's why they're causing earthquakes, and that's how they're getting into. They're poisoning people, and there's people in western North Dakota right now that document how they get these skin rashes, and cows' tails fall off. And we take all that information, and we put it on a site that we call No Fracking Way. And that was kind of our theme cry all the way through this process. We had a friend from Montana that sent us that suggestion. She said, why don't you call your group No Fracking Way? And that's what we did. We adopted that. And on Facebook, we have a page called No Fracking Way, and we post on it daily. Sometimes 3 or 4 articles a day are posted there about fracking and the processes, the legislation, the court cases. We did a lot in the DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, where demonstrators and protectors were happening in Standing Rock. We had a lot of information out there about their issues, and now that the courts are starting to realize that there was a lot of collusion going on between the companies and the law enforcement in Morton County, we have all that information that we're posting out there so people see really, you know, what these companies are doing, how they, you know, just ran their bulldozers over those sacred sites and had no regard for the people. And now they're finding that water protectors actually were not being violent. It was the company and the people they were hiring.
So everybody listening out there, go and like the Facebook page No Fracking Way, which has a lot of great information as well as just a really cool name.
Who view it and who are members, so we invite anybody who's interested to. And we refer students to it because we get a lot of questions from students, and we say, you know, we can give you the general information, but if you're doing papers and if you're wanting to know more, we suggest you visit that site and just scroll through. You'll find lots of good information there.
Well, and I remember a comment you made at the very beginning when this was all getting started, when people were saying, oh, well, it's not such a big deal. And I remember you saying, won't they be disappointed when they find out they can't drink oil?
We actually have a quote. We put quotes in our Water Act, and we have a quote from one of our councilmen in there who said when we were discussing this with them, and his quote was, you know, that our water will be more valuable than gold someday. And we have tribal stories. I grew up with a tribal story where my dad used to say, we need to protect the water at the Holy Spring. And there's a place on our reservation where the water is called the Holy Spring, and it's a spring that where the water just comes flowing out of the ground. And he used to say, we're supposed to protect this water because someday it'll be the only water left to drink in the world. And I used to think that was far-fetched. I thought, the world? Why would they come all the way here from wherever to get water? But if you go to different tribes have similar stories, and so it's like in our ceremonies and in our stories, our ancestors documented within teachings that water was going to be in danger someday, so we needed to be alerted within our tribes that we had to protect our water because something is going to happen somewhere down the road where our water will be the only water. And so it's kind of like telling us to be aware that this is valuable and you need to pay attention.
All right, well, we want to get 2 more things in today, and then I want to have you come back another time. In fact, maybe even when I'm up in North Dakota, then we could just record it there. But the 2 things we really, really wanted to make sure we got in today were to ask you about being married for 53 years, and then we also wanted to get your tip. Now, I know Maria has just been at your 10th anniversary is coming up, right?
Yep, it'll be 10 years, August 3rd. But obviously that pales in comparison to 53 years.
So now everybody out listening to this is wondering, you know, when half of marriages end in divorce, when so few people manage to stay married for that length of time, what is your secret? Is it just that you're so amazing that Len was lucky to be married to you and went along with everything you said? That's what I'm going to tell my husband was.
I don't know. I think we pick our fights. I don't know. I just figure whenever it comes time to just, you know, want to be crazy and argue or something. I just say, is it worth it? You know, is it really going to make a difference? And sometimes you just have to just let things go, because if you're going to kiss and make up, what's the use to argue, you know? we're like any married couple. We've had a lot of issues in our marriage. The time I, for example, when I emptied our account for me to go to Seattle, you know, we've had those major kinds of problems and issues, and we just sort of seem to be able to forgive each other and move on. Having the same goal, you know, we were on our anniversary when we were visiting about what we did when we were young and so forth. We both kind of agreed that having the same vision for, and I remember, I shared this with him. I said, I remember telling my dad that I thought you and I were a lot alike because we had the same thoughts about wanting to work, wanting to have a good home, wanting to have a car, where a lot of people in those days, and wanting to go to school, wanting an education, where a lot of the people here at that time didn't really see all that. And I had an aunt who worked for the BIA, and I wanted to be a secretary because she had running water, she had electricity, she had a car, and you know, most people didn't have that. Well, almost nobody had it if they didn't live in the BIA compound. So I thought that was my goal. I wanted to be a secretary so I could have those things. And lo and behold, here comes Lynn, and he's kind of got the same idea. You know, I really want to go to school and get a job, and really, I want a car, too. You know, I'd like to have a home, and I don't want to have to live with our parents forever, and, you know, those kind of things. So I think, you know, having that common goal, and then we just sort of kept it up, you know. We just sort of kept working together to get the things we wanted, and the marital problems and those kind of things always kind of took a back seat because we had our focus on something other than ourselves or our own personal, I guess is what it is. We were looking more at, you know, what we had together.
We'll be right back.
Did you know that 92% of U.S. homes have a computer? Yes. Yes, they do. And 43% of homes have a child under 18. Why aren't more kids playing educational games on those computers? Because they suck. The educational games, not the kids. Until now, download Spirit Lake or Fish Lake. Check out Forgotten Trail or Making Camp with no download required. All of our games are under $10. Teach math and social studies. Let your child play on a real computer and learn real-life math. If you're on Steam, be the coolest aunt, uncle, big brother, or sister on the block and download Fish Lake. The little rugrat can play on your computer, learn fractions, and you can get some peace while you talk on the phone to Vin.
Well, this is our final segment of our podcast where we ask our guests to give us a tip. And it can be a tip on anything. It can be, you know, you talked a little bit about the secret to being married for 53 years, although that still just seems like so overwhelming, such a long amount of time that I feel like there has to be some more behind that one. But what do you wish you had known, or what do you wish someone had told you, or you, I know you have kids and grandkids, what's something that you've told them that you think is just really valuable for people to know, or to the people that you're talking about? There's so many different things, you know, anti-fracking, anything. What is one tip that you would give someone if they said, what's one piece of advice?
I think the piece of advice that I would give, especially to young people, is to surround yourself with good people. Surround yourself with people that have similar goals to you. You know, don't be afraid to pray. Don't be afraid to face your issues. Don't blame people when things go wrong. Always figure out how you can make things better, because, you know, we all live each our own individual lives, and nobody's going to come and make your life better. They're too busy trying to make their own life better. So, you know, I guess those things, take responsibility and realize that you can chart your course. You can do what you want to do, and don't let the little setbacks become a way of life. Just figure your way through it and move on.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7generationgames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at sevengenerationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.